Welcome along. It's Saturday afternoon here on Premier Christian Radio. I'm your host, Justin Brierley, for the next hour and a half. This is the programme that brings Christians and non-Christians together every week. It's called Unbelievable, and it's a talking shop for those who have an interest in faith, the big questions of life. And today we're looking at something which, we'll explain what it means, but we're going to call it by its technical term to start off with: presuppositional apologetics.
You're unbelievable.
What on earth does that mean, you may say? Well, we're going to be finding out with the help of Cy Ten Bruggenkate, who is on the phone from Canada on my show today. He's a Christian, and he says that we can show that by accepting the laws of logic, mathematics, science and morality, there's no option left but to believe that there is a God. Well, Paul Baird is my atheist joining me on the programme today. Well, he describes himself as more as a free thinker, and we'll find out why, as he engages in conversation with Cy on this whole question of whether we can prove that God exists in the way that Cy believes you can. Hope you enjoy the programme today here on the show that gets you thinking. Well, a warm welcome to both my guests. Don't forget, if you're listening and you'd like to let someone else know about this show as well, then you can find out more at the Unbelievable webpage, premier.org.uk/unbelievable. Perhaps we'll start off, though, today with Cy, who joins us from across the big old pond. You're in Canada, Cy. Cy, I must first of all start by asking you, your name is one of the most unusual I've come across in quite a while. Cy Ten Bruggenkate. Is that a particular brand of Canadian sort of background that gives you that interesting name?
Actually, well, hello, Justin, and hello, Paul.
Hello.
Ten Bruggenkate is a Dutch name, and my parents are from Holland. My father's actually from Indonesia. But ten is a prefix like van or de in Dutch, so in Dutch it's actually Ten Bruggenkate, but I won't make you say that.
Ah, okay. Well, thank you for coming on anyway. And you got in touch with me having come across the programme and engaging a little bit on our forum on the Premier community. Tell us a little bit about you, though, before we go into the topic of today's programme, Cy. You're a Christian. Would you say you've always been a Christian in some sense?
I was born and raised in a Christian home, and I don't remember a time when I didn't profess Christ as Lord.
And has your faith undergone any changes in that time? Would you say you've developed this particular stance you take now out of experiences that you've had?
Well, I would say that growing up, I never doubted the existence of God, ever. But my faith definitely has changed by leaps and bounds, especially when I discovered this form of apologetics, or by the grace of God, was shown this form of apologetics.
This is, in a sense, your life's work, your ministry. Do you feel like people just don't have a grasp of the underlying foundations, in some sense, of what we're dealing with when we're talking about God?
Well, I think they have a grasp of the underlying foundations, but they suppress them. Christians suppress them for, you know, whatever reason, but unbelievers suppress them because they don't want to believe in God. They're at enmity with God. So they have a reason for suppressing it. But I think that everybody recognizes the foundations, but they suppress them.
Well, we're going to get into this whole area very shortly. But let me first of all introduce my other guest on the program today, Paul Baird. Paul, thank
Hi.
You for coming into the studio today. It was great to sort of get to know you a little through the Premier community. That's
a
place
pleasure.
Where you've been interacting on a regular basis. But tell us, first of all, a little of yourself, Paul. I understand you were actually born and raised in sort of Church of England background originally.
Yeah, my mother was a very religious person for all of her life, and raised us as Church of England, and then later, once we moved to Ireland, as Church of Ireland. And I was also raised, to a lesser extent, by my father, firstly through the Presbyterian Church and then through the Spiritualist Church. I didn't feel too comfortable with that, and I think part of the teenage rebellion was to move away from it, although totally moving away from it took quite a number of years. And even having moved away from the Christian sense of spirituality, I was still attracted to a certain sense of spirituality. So I moved into paganism. But even then, I think even though I was a pagan for a number of years, I didn't get the sense of spiritual satisfaction that I was perhaps expecting. And eventually left that to become a person who would describe themselves not as an out-and-out, hardcore, Dawkins-type atheist, but somebody who would say, I am a free thinker about the subject.
Right. It's been an interesting journey then.
Very much.
I mean, at this point, though, you feel that, what is it, the evidence has led you to believe that we don't have sufficient proof for a god? Would that be?
I would say that the evidence for the various incarnations of God have insufficient evidence for us to be absolutely certain that they are correct.
Okay. I mean, in a sense, you know, at the very foundation, when all people of religious belief, if you like, may say they believe in some sense of God. I mean, you're not keen on the title atheist, I think, because of the connotations that it has. But I mean, would it be more realistic to say you're agnostic on the issue of God? Do you say, actually, on balance, I really don't think there is a God?
I would say that on balance, I don't think there is a God, but for different reasons, perhaps, than you're alluding to, which is that one thing that Christians speak about quite a lot is the spiritual experience being blessed, if you like, by the Holy Spirit, having some sense that something in their lives has changed, really quite fundamentally. They've had an experience. Mm. And what I have found is that being in church, being in chapel, being in a public Christian gathering, being at a pagan moot, being at a pagan ceremony, I didn't feel that. But that doesn't mean that there have not been occasions where I have, and that is the bit that I find difficult, is that whereas people of religion say, yes, I've had this experience, it has moved me, I sort of say, well, that hasn't moved me, but there have been other things that are absolutely not religious that have moved me. And that's why I can't sort of say, no, I'm a hardcore atheist and there isn't one.
Well, I think we'll have an interesting discussion today anyway, because the topic that we're looking at is presuppositional apologetics. Now, I'm going to return again to Si at this point to give us an explanation, Si, of what that means. We don't want to put people off with jargon today, because as far as you're concerned, this is something that the vast majority of people can grasp. So tell us about what this is and why you believe that this approach to engaging with people really is the most effective way of showing that there is a God and it matters.
First of all, I don't think it's necessarily the most effective way, but it's the biblical way. But I have to tell you, like, for a North American debating with a British atheist, I think that we're at a distinct disadvantage to start with. Because from North America, we think that the British accent tends to add about 50 IQ points.
Trust me, I don't have that advantage over you.
I think if Dawkins was from Iowa, no one would have given him the time of day.
Or Christopher Hitchens either, perhaps.
That's right. As far as the presuppositional apologetic goes, as long as I can remember, I've had a deep desire to defend the truth of Christianity, but for most of my adult life, I was doing it wrong. I was not glorifying my Lord and Savior in my apologetic. I was using a man-centered apologetic rather than a Christ-centered apologetic. Man-centered apologetic agrees with the unbeliever that man is the authority. Sadly, this is the apologetic that the vast majority of Christians are using. Presuppositional apologetics, on the other hand, defends the view that God is the ultimate authority over all aspects of life. It's what's known as a worldview apologetic. We defend the truth of Christianity as a whole rather than piece by piece. We demonstrate that things like knowledge and proof make sense in the Christian worldview with Christian presuppositions, but they do not make sense in the unbeliever's worldview with their presuppositions. We take the biblical view of faith, that it's not a blind leap. It does not take over where reason leaves off, but faith in God is the foundation of all reasoning. Not just Christian reasoning, but atheistic reasoning as well. It is only through faith in God that we can be certain of anything. Hebrews 11:1 defines faith as being sure of what we hope for and certain of what we do not see. Since faith in God is the foundation of all knowledge, and unbelievers actually do know things, it follows that they do actually know God and are suppressing the truth about him, just as it says in Romans 1.
Let me just break in there. So essentially what you're saying is that the system of, if you like, approaching the way to view God, effectively actually address, you would say that there is no excuse in some sense for someone denying God. Everyone actually, whether they sort of acknowledge it or not, does believe in God because of the way that they think, the things that they do.
That's right, and that's precisely what it says in Romans 1. The interesting thing about that is that, you know, we give evidence to all these people, but if they were to drop dead today, would they have an excuse? Ask any Christian and they'll say no, they are without excuse. Why? Because they already know God.
I mean, just referencing Romans 1, let's just, for those who are not familiar with the passage you're talking about there, that's verses 18 to 21. And it says there, the wrath of God is being revealed from heaven against all the godlessness and wickedness of men who suppress the truth by their wickedness, since what may be known about God is plain to them, because God has made it plain to them. For since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that men are without excuse. So this is, if you like, a key verse in terms of this type of apologetic. It's this idea that no one's got any excuse, if you like. No one can, at the judgment day, say to God, there wasn't enough evidence, as Bertrand Russell famously said, if you were presented with God at death, what would you say to him? And he said, why didn't you show me more evidence that you existed? You're saying, actually, we've got all the evidence we need, and people who still refuse to believe in God are simply suppressing the truth that they actually know deep inside.
Well, that's the whole point of this. It's not a matter of what I say. It's a matter of what God says. And he says that these people have enough evidence, that they know for certain that he exists and are without excuse for denying him. And that's the thing about this apologetic. It's nothing to do with what I say. It has to do with what God says in his word.
Well, carry on and describe then how this unfolds.
All right. Presuppositional apologetic, it defends the consistency of the Christian worldview and exposes the inconsistency of a worldview where man is the authority. The Christian has as his ultimate authority the Word of God. From the Scriptures, we see that all knowledge is founded on God. Proverbs 1:7 tells us that the fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. Colossians 2:3 tells us that all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge are hidden in Christ. The unbeliever, on the other hand, says that all knowledge is gained via sense and reason, which is not dependent on God. They maintain that they can think for themselves and by themselves. They are autonomous, a law unto themselves. The Bible says that knowledge that is not based on the authority of Jesus Christ is not knowledge at all, but it calls it false knowledge. Paul actually warns Timothy about engaging in reasoning where Christ is not the authority. In 1 Timothy 6:20, he says, Timothy, guard what has been entrusted to your care. Turn away from godless chatter and the opposing ideas of what is falsely called knowledge. Now, of course, the unbeliever does not agree that all knowledge comes from God, and will come up with fine-sounding arguments to justify their ability to know things apart from God. But listen to what Paul warns the Colossians in chapter 2, verse 4. Now, this is right after he tells us that all knowledge is hidden in Christ. He says, I tell you this so that no one may deceive you by fine-sounding arguments. And then in verse 8, he says, see to it that no one takes you captive through hollow and deceptive philosophy, which depends on human tradition and the basic principles of this world rather than on Christ. Yet this is precisely what Christians are doing today.
And this is a criticism you would even level at this program. Obviously, we deal mainly in a branch of what might be termed evidential apologetics, which is, well, look at this argument, you know, because the beginning, of, you know, the universe is fine-tuned, that points towards a God, or look at the evidence for the resurrection of Jesus Christ, there's an argument to prove God. These, for you, are subsidiary arguments to this, what is for you the biblical approach, which is this one of, you know, if you like, it's kind of from first principles, I think, is kind of where it comes from.
It's not my job, I think, to level criticisms. It's my job to speak the truth. If people are convicted by this truth, that they are believing the unbeliever when they talk about the condition of their heart rather than God, well, hopefully that the changes will reflect that. But, I mean, there have been flashes of presuppositional apologetics in your shows, and I think that you've actually indicated that, and we could talk about that a little bit later on. But I think that this is the biblical apologetic, and if people are convicted otherwise, I thank God for that.
So when it comes down to it, there's sort of, if you like, four areas of law, as I understand it, that you would say you need to look at. And I would recommend that people engage, actually, in your website, which is a really interesting way you've set that up, is a kind of point-and-click way of taking you through the argument and leading you to sets of conclusions. And if you want to visit that and see what I mean by that, go to proofthatgodexists.org. That's proofthatgodexists.org. And you'll kind of get a very good sense of Tsai's approach with this form of presuppositional apologetics. But okay, take us to the next stage then, Tsai. How does this all coalesce and come together in terms of when you present it to someone?
Well, typically when the unbeliever wants to debate with us, they want us to take a neutral position. And in the name of open-mindedness, we happily oblige. But who is the authority of a neutral position? Man. The position is not neutral at all. We're giving up our position that God is the authority and assuming the position that man is the authority. If you use the unbeliever's authority rather than the authority of Scripture, you lose before you start. It's like getting on the unbeliever's airplane. It doesn't matter what you talk about, you're going to the unbeliever's destination. Now, here's an example. Let's say that you appeal to the ultimate authority of the unbeliever, his senses and reasoning, and you used evidences to prove beyond doubt that Jesus rose from the dead. The unbeliever could easily say, wow, strange things happen in this world, and someday we'll have a naturalistic explanation as to why that body came back to life. In the meantime, call Ripley's Believe It or Not. You see, you prove that Jesus rose from the dead, but there's no reason for him to give up his ultimate authority. But it's even worse than that. Let's say the person says, yes, you've met my standard of proof, and I want to become a Christian. The problem is his ultimate authority still has not changed. He's being the judge over whether or not God exists based on his standard of reasoning rather than bowing the knee and submitting to Christ. Now, let's say the next week that same person sees a Richard Dawkins video, and now the balance of evidence seems to sway the other way. Does he cease being a Christian? That's one of the dangers of using bad apologetics. Now, God can and has used bad apologetics to genuinely bring people to him, but there may be many people walking this earth who think they are Christians when their human reasoning is still the judge over God. For the Christian, the foundation of reasoning is the Word of God. See, we even believe things that our senses and reasoning would tell us cannot happen. We believe that a man came back to life after being dead for 3 days. See, when there are things we don't understand, we're supposed to trust God and His Word rather, you know, for that for our foundation for reasoning. Proverbs 3, 5, and 6 says, trust in the Lord with all your heart, and lean not on your own understanding. In all your ways acknowledge him, and he will make your path straight. The role of the apologetics, then, is to constantly demonstrate the tension between worldviews and doggedly stick to it. In Peter 1:3, Christians are commanded to answer anyone who asks a reason for the hope that they have. Doing apologetics the wrong way is tough. It's not only unbiblical, it's very intimidating because you have to be as smart as the physicist, the microbiologist, the university professor, the psychologist, in order to be able to argue with them. But when we set apart Christ as Lord, as the beginning of verse 15 states, we become equipped to handle any objection to Christianity. We see that all objections to Christianity are actually based on the truth of Christianity. When God commands us to do something, he also equips us. You see, this apologetic, it's not about fragments of paper, it's not about dinosaurs, it's not about carbon 14 dating, it's about proclaiming the certainty of the Lordship of Jesus Christ. See, I want people to repent for denying the God they know exists rather than believing in a so-called God who only probably exists. Now, Paul, he wants objective proof that God exists. Well, here it is. Since the very concept of proof is dependent on God, the proof that God exists is that without him, you couldn't prove anything.
That's so
okay.
Good.
Well, let's we're going to examine that, okay? Because now you've done a great job, if you like, of laying out, you know, the background to this and why you feel this is such an important approach. As you say, it's about in your eyes, side taking the argument out of the ballpark of the atheist and putting it in the Christian ballpark and saying, no, we need to converse in this ballpark. But we'll find out whether Paul's convinced that we need to move into your ballpark. So you're listening to a show. Again, don't be put off by the jargon, but we're talking about presuppositional apologetics. It's sort of a way of approaching proof of God. And with us on the show, Tsai ten Bruggenkate, who says that by simply accepting that there are laws of logic, mathematics, science, and morality that, in a sense, we have to use every day, we are left no room but to believe that there is a God. And we're going to be examining that claim with the help of Paul Baird, who's an atheist on the program today. Well, free thinker, I think, is the way that we're referring to Paul. So if you'd like to get in touch, of course, the usual means are open. You can email me, unbelievable@premier.org.uk, or you can phone 08456 52 52 52 and select option 8 to leave me a voicemail message. And don't forget, this programme available now as a podcast at premier.org.uk/unbelievable.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, we sort of had to spend a little time laying the ground there, if you like. But Paul, perhaps we'll come back to you now, and then then have Si respond. What's your initial reaction? You said at the end there, well, it seems circular to me when.
Well, I'd like actually, if I may, to go back to the example that Si gave of the use of evidence in terms of proving the resurrection. It's a conversation I've had with another Christian actually last night, and we were sort of discussing just what would it take to convince an atheist that the resurrection had happened. And I said to him, well, if we had affidavits from the Roman guards standing at the foot of the cross, that they'd seen the resurrection take place, they'd seen the body taken down, they'd seen the body taken to the grave, they'd stayed by the body, and they'd actually seen the stone being rolled away and Jesus come out, and they'd stayed with Jesus all through the 40 days and watched him ascend to heaven, and that was documented and that was authenticated, would an atheist accept it? And I said, no. And that is really the key. Evidence is not the issue. Belief is the issue. If you believe that Jesus was the Son of God, born of a virgin, died on the cross, was resurrected after the third day and ascended to heaven 40 days later, then believe it. If you try and go down the evidential route, you will lose. Because the counterpoint to the scenario that I've just laid out is, if there were Roman soldiers standing at the foot of the cross and they were able to file affidavits to say, well, actually, yes, Jesus, he was crucified. We did take the body down. We did put him in the grave. And it wasn't his grave the guy came out of. Would a Christian accept it? No, because you're coming back to what is it you actually believe. So I think evidence, it's a very sticky road to go down, I think.
In a sense, I'm guessing you sort of, to some extent, agree with that, Si.
I agree with everything that Paul just said. He's exactly right. I think, I hope and pray that Paul becomes a Christian because he'll make a great apologist.
Not likely to happen.
I actually find him more consistent when he talks about God in the forums than the Christians he's debating with. I agree with Paul more than the Christians he's debating with.
Well, isn't that interesting? But tell us then, let's just treat this now as a conversation, okay, between you and Paul. I'll stick my oar in occasionally, but go for it then, Si. If Paul is not getting convinced at all by evidential arguments, how are you aiming to convince him?
Well, first of all, I see that Paul is very open-minded when he discusses with people. He seems to be very kind and very witty, and I actually like him. Now, I'm not commanded to like Paul. I'm commanded to love him. So, I mean, I do like what he says. But I'd like to know, like what you talked about earlier, what type of atheist is. He does not deny that there's a possibility that God exists. Is that correct?
I would say that on the balance of probabilities, it's unlikely that the Christian view of God exists, as set out in the Bible.
But you don't deny the possibility.
Is this the Christian God or any God?
The Christian God. Is it impossible that the Christian God exists?
No, because that's an absolute.
Right. Okay, so it's not impossible. Now, if such a God exists, the Christian concept is that he's omniscient and he's omnipotent. If such a God exists, could he reveal some things to his creatures such that they can know them for certain, if such a God exists?
I think that the point that you're making highlights one of the issues, I should say, that I have with your website. Which is the use of absolutes? You're saying God is omnipresent, God is omnipotent, which are both actually quite absolutes. He's everywhere and he can do anything. And I find that I have issues with it. I really, really do have issues with it.
Well, naturally, because you're an unbeliever. But my question is, if it's possible, like you concede the possibility that such a God exists, even if it's you think it's the remotest possibility, that you think it's highly unlikely. If it's possible that such a God exists, could he reveal things to us such that we can know them for certain? Could such a God do that?
Again, you're using the word for certain, and to me that's an absolute, and I would say no.
So it would be impossible for God to do that?
No. On the balance of probabilities, it would be...
On the balance of probabilities, it would be unlikely, but it would be possible
yes.
that God could do that to and reveal things to us so that we can know them for certain. You say it's improbable, but it is possible.
What I'm saying is that I do not think that your conception of God, the Christian conception of God, could do something for certain.
I understand that, but you don't know for certain that that's possible. You just say you don't believe it's possible, but technically, if we were to go down to the technical route, it would be possible.
There I would have to ask, where is your evidence?
No, the thing is, we're not talking about evidence now. I'm asking you on a philosophical basis, if such a God exists, which you concede that it's remotely possible, but it is possible, if such a God exists, could he reveal things to his creation such that we can know them for certain? It's a simple question. Either yes, it's possible, no, it's impossible. If it's impossible, I want to know how you know for certain that it's impossible. Now, you don't believe in certainties or absolutes, so you can't say that it's impossible. So you'd have to concede that such a thing is possible.
Let me just get this straight. Now, you're asking, Cy, here, of Paul, is it possible that such a God exists that he would reveal things that we can absolutely know to be true? Now, I'm guessing, Paul, you're unwilling to say that you think that is possible, that is the case. But it sounds like you're not ruling it out. You wouldn't want to say it's impossible. You'll say it's possible, I don't. But personally,
the way that I would answer it is, I do not accept the exclusivity of the Christian God as it is being put forward to be able to provide that certain evidence. And I think that is the key.
I realize, Paul, that you don't accept it because you're an unbeliever. I'm not asking you to accept it. I'm asking you if it's possible. Theoretically, is this possible?
Yeah, only in theory. We're not saying you believe it, therefore. Just is it possible, logically? Let's go
down that particular route for the sake of the argument.
Okay. We're going to go down that route, but we're going to do it in the next half of the programme because we're already eating away into our programme time here. You're going to be hearing in the next section of the programme Cy ten Bruggenkaet and freethinker Paul Baird discussing whether we can prove that God exists by looking at essentially the tools by which we think, logic, mathematics, science and even morality. Cy says, if you accept those laws, or even one set of those laws, that they are, if you like, exist immaterially from ourselves, objectively, in some way, then you have no option to believe that there is a God, because we simply cannot make sense of those laws themselves without that. So we're going to be getting into this more in the next section of the programme as we look at presuppositional apologetics. Do join me again in a couple of minutes' time.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Can we prove that God exists, not just from arguments, from evidence, but, if you like, from foundational principles? We're looking at the whole area of what's called presuppositional apologetics. Cy ten Bruggenkaet, on the phone from Canada, he says that by simply accepting that there are laws of logic, mathematics, science and morality, we've got no option left but to believe there is a God. Paul Baird is our free thinker on the programme who contests that, and we'll be hearing their conversation in the rest of the programme today. If you want to get in touch, as usual, the email address is unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Let's come back to you, Cy. In a sense, we need to obviously move this argument forward. And just as we finished that last section, you and Paul were tussling with whether Paul has to concede that it's possible that the God you describe exists and can, if you like, if it's possible for that God to exist, it's possible that that God would give people revelations that so that they can know something exists. This is obviously fundamental to this whole area. Tell us why.
Well, as a free thinker, Paul has to concede this fact because he says that certainty is impossible. So he has to concede the fact that this is possible because he doesn't know everything. And this is fundamental too, because this is the basis of the Christian worldview, that we can know things for certain. Now, he could disagree with that. I have no problem with him disagreeing with it. But not being able to know everything, he has to be able to concede this possibility.
Oh, as we said during the break, I think for the sake of the argument, I'll concede that just so we can move this on.
Okay. Now, I appreciate that. Now, my question is, how are you able to know anything for certain?
In what regard?
In anything. Do you know anything? And if so, what do you know? And how are you able to know it?
Okay, I know I exist.
Now, how do you know you exist?
That's axiomatic, though, isn't it?
Well, the thing is...
It has to be the start point for the conversation.
The I'm sort not... of cogito ergo sum, I think, therefore, I am. Right. Would that be the idea?
Yeah. And I am independent of my own senses.
That was Descartes' postulation, I think, therefore I am. But it was Bertrand Russell, an atheistic philosopher, who actually pointed out that Descartes was begging the question. We have to look at the syllogism that Descartes was using. He said, as his first proposition, I think. His second proposition is, in order to think, I must exist. And his conclusion is, therefore I exist. The problem is, the conclusion, I exist, is assumed in the first premise, I think. In order to not beg the question, the first premise should be, there's thinking going on. And I'd like to know how you get from there's thinking going on to I exist. I'm saying it can't be done.
I say it can be done to my satisfaction. I don't have to prove I exist to you. I have to prove I exist to me, and I have, because I'm talking to you.
Now, proof, you would say that you have to know things and it has to be true. So you're talking about a belief system. You're not talking about proof. Now, would you agree that in order to prove something, it has to be true?
No, I think you're muddying the waters there. In order to prove that I exist, the only person I can actually prove my existence to is me. I cannot prove my existence to you or even to Justin, who's sitting opposite me.
So you're saying that proof doesn't have to be true?
But the proof is true. I am existing.
How do you know that?
Because I am existing.
Don't you find that to be a circular argument? I exist because I exist.
No.
I said God exists because he exists. You wouldn't accept that from me. And that's the thing we have to point out. That
why not?
Viciously circular.
Why not? If God exists, God exists. It doesn't matter whether I deny him or accept him. He exists.
But is it a valid argument to say God exists because he exists?
It makes a certain sort of sense to me.
Okay, well then you have to be a Christian.
No, I don't. I can be a pagan and still make that statement. That is the problem.
It's valid that God exists because God exists because God exists. That's a valid argument. You have to accept it now.
But you can also say God does not exist because God does not exist.
But not knowing anything... I mean, if it's an arbitrary thing, why don't you just arbitrarily choose my position?
Because I choose not to.
Why is that?
Because, as I keep coming back to you, I know I exist because I know I exist.
And that's a circular argument. So you have no reason other than a circular argument.
It's not a circular argument. The certainty is I exist.
Your sense, though, here, Si, is that Paul is in some way basing his entire foundation for reasoning on a circular argument, then?
Viciously circular argument.
No, I would disagree. You have to begin somewhere. Where is my start point? I have to start with my own existence. If I do not exist, I cannot postulate anything.
That's right.
How do I know I exist? I know I exist because I am here existing.
Are we at a stalemate here, gentlemen? What do you think, Si?
No, not at all. I think we can carry on for here, but I think that the listeners, you know, they'll be able to see. Now, the thing is, Paul is not going to accept the validity of this argument because he's an unbeliever. And that's the very point. Now, when God says in the Psalms, he doesn't say the brilliant philosopher says in his heart there is no God. He doesn't say the brilliant mathematician says in his heart there is no God. He says the fool says in his heart there is no God. Now, that's not name-calling. That's a description of the intellectual position of the unbeliever. When somebody can say, I exist because I exist, it's not circular. You know, he doesn't have to accept that that's foolish. But I think from an objective view, we can see the foolishness of it. Now, the thing is, that's not the only circularity. Now, Paul, he starts as his premise, what I would say is a circular argument. He doesn't have to agree with me. That's fine. But now Paul is reasoning with me. He's reasoning with me about all of these issues. My next question is, on what reason do you trust the validity of your reasoning?
Right, so we're having a discussion here. We're obviously having to reason, you know, to make our points. Mm-hmm. On what basis do you accept that your reasoning is, if you like, valid, Paul?
I think that reasoning has been based on the way that I was brought up, the way that I was educated, and the society that I live in.
Now, you see, when Paul gives me a reason to justify his reasoning, do you know what he's doing? He's opening his Bible. The problem is he wrote his own Bible.
No, I'm not.
Go on, then. What is the explain that, then.
Well, the thing is, he's giving me reasons for trusting his reasoning. But how does he know those reasons are valid? He trusts it before he comes to his reasoning. And that's my point. I want to know how he knows his reasoning about his upbringing, about his childhood, and all that is valid. He assumes it on blind faith.
What I sense you're asking is, you're using reasons to justify your position, Paul. Now, on what basis do you hold that your reasoning is, if you like, the right kind of reasoning?
Okay.
How you know, and even if you say, it's my background, etc., that leads me to reason in this way, well, that's a reason you're giving. What's the undergirding
I would say that...
Why do you trust your reasoning skills?
I trust my reasoning based on feedback that I receive from other people that I interact with.
And you use your reasoning to understand that interaction. Of course you do. You presuppose the validity of your reasoning in order to prove that it's valid.
No, if I was raised in a different society which had different social mores and norms, the way that I would reason would be different to the way that I reason living here in the United Kingdom.
So the laws of logic would be different, let's say, in Africa if you were born and raised there?
No, the social norms would be. And that's completely different from logic. But the way that I would reason what is right and what is wrong about particular scenarios or about particular moral situations would indeed be different.
Okay, now, again, that's what we call a red herring, because that is not answering my question. And we're at another impasse, and I can go on from here, but it's my point that you trust your reasoning based on the validity of your reasoning, that you talk about other societies, but the thing is, you are trusting your reasoning in order to make that explanation. You're opening your Bible. That's my point. But we can continue from this if you like.
Okay, but do I understand your overall point here being, Si, that Paul is kind of obliged to use reasoning to... justify his reasoning ability, and you're saying that is circular unless you believe there's something, presumably, and I'm guessing you believe it's God, to, if you like, give the foundation for that.
Well, that's one correction I want to make, because you've mentioned this a couple times throughout the show. It's not that God is the conclusion because there are laws of logic, because there are reasoning. I'm saying God is a necessary starting point to make sense of any of them. That's what presuppositional apologetics is. See, because I can say that I believe in a God who's created me with the ability to reason. He commands us to reason. In Isaiah 1:18, it says, "Come, let us reason together," says the Lord. He's given us that ability. That's how I can entrust my ability to reason, because I know that it's a good God who's created me. And I'm saying that if you don't start with that presupposition, you cannot make sense of reasoning. And you listen to Paul, he's trusting his reasoning based on his ability to reason. That shows that when he trusts his reasoning, he really does know that God exists. Because otherwise his explanation is viciously circular.
No, I'd say your argument is actually circular. I can reason without accepting the existence of any God, be that Christian, pagan, Jewish, or Muslim.
It's not a matter of accepting it. It's how you account for it without presupposing that God exists. And I'm saying that you cannot. Now, one of the things you're saying that my argument is circular. Is circular reasoning absolutely fallacious?
I like the way that you do that, Si. I do. I really do like the way that you do that. You use the word absolutely and absolute,
right?
Too much, and I think there is a grave danger in doing that.
In order for something to be fallacious, it has to contravene absolute laws of logic. If there are no absolute laws of logic, then no reasoning is fallacious. And I know you believe in fallacious reading because I read throughout the forum how you criticize Christians for using logical fallacies, the straw man fallacy, the question. You brought that a number of times, but if logic is not absolute, there can be no fallacies.
Oh, this is good. Let's go down this route. Let's come out with an absolute law of logic. Could you name one?
A is A. I could say the law of non-contradiction.
Oh, yes, good. Right, let's go down that road. I was having a look at your website, myself and a number of other atheists, we were having a look at this, and the one that we came across was... the absolute law of logic. Now, I can accept a law of non-contradiction. What I cannot accept is an absolute law of non-contradiction. I don't accept they are the same.
So you do accept that it's the same?
No, I don't accept that they are the same.
So you do accept that it's the same?
No.
See, if it's not absolute, then I can contradict you and you have no objection.
Let's have a look at the absolute law of contradiction then.
I'd be happy to.
So, can you give me a scenario where the law of contradiction applies?
I would say that it applies everywhere, that we cannot contradict. And I can not only tell you that it applies everywhere, I can tell you why it applies. Because contradicting yourself amounts to lying, and God commands us not to lie. Not only can the unbeliever not give us a justification for the absolute law of non-contradiction, they can't tell us why we have to absolutely apply it.
Let me just, catch up here, okay? The law of non-contradiction is a logical law, okay? Mm-hmm. We're saying, for instance, I think it would help if we did give an example, okay? If I said, this apple is here, this apple is not here.
Mm-hmm. At the same time and in the same
At the same time, in the same place. Mm-hmm. There's obviously a contradiction there,
yeah.
Okay? That law stands wherever you are, whoever you are, wherever you find yourself in the universe. This is a law that is just a brute fact, if you like.
That, I think, is where Cy and I would disagree. I would say that the absolute law, which is the phrase that Cy uses, is not an absolute law. It's a law of contradiction in the sense that it is a tool that we use for analysing. It is not our master. And there are instances where people have come up with things like the Barber paradox, and also where people have actually looked into instances, can you actually have an instance where A is what it is and also what it not is? And there is, I believe, a school of logic that would contend that that is actually possible. And I think one of the things that, or one of the scenarios that Cy comes up with is the car park. The car is either in the car park or the car is not in the car park. And I think that that then encourages one to actually think of scenarios where the car can be in the car park and not in the car park at the same time.
And in the same way.
And in the same way, yeah.
But won't most people come at this and say, look, guys, let's just be commonsensical about this, okay? Let's sort of not go off into these, philosophical realms of when cars can be in both in and not in the car park. You know, we kind of have to use the laws of logic on an everyday basis that if something is there, then it's there, and if it's not there, it's not there. And
I think the key is how you describe that we use logic. Logic does not actually use us.
Are you trying to suggest that logic is not, if you like, out there a kind of objective fact of itself, which exists independently of us?
No.
It is dependent upon us.
Yes, yes. And it's our ability to actually set logic aside as an analytical tool in order to think outside the envelope. If, as a human society, we relied solely on logic, there would be so many discoveries that we would not have been able to make. I think the adage, if it ain't broke, don't fix it, is very logical. And you have to actually set that aside in order to be able to invent something. You have to be able to almost make a logical leap. You have to put logic to one side. Now, could you really do that if the laws of logic were absolute and you had to always obey them?
Cy?
See the irony here? That you have a Christian talking with a non-Christian, and it's the non-Christian who says you have to set aside logic. That is the total flip, the total reverse of what is generally said. People say that Christians are illogical. Now here Paul is saying, in order to get along, you have to set aside logic. I mean, I could go on and I could contradict him now until the cows come home, and he would have no objection because he says that the law of non-contradiction is not necessarily absolute. So he has no absolute reason for applying it to me.
I mean, are we going to get anywhere in our conversation then, I'm wondering? Because, Paul, from your point of view, you're saying I'm just not going to accede to any of Cy's initial kind of, if you like, conditions, that there is a law of logic and that it applies everywhere at all times and in all places.
Yeah. I mean, I think that that's quite true because of the word absolute that's being applied. I would not accept that... using the word absolute in terms of things like absolute truth, absolute laws of logic, And from that, deducing that God must therefore exist, I really don't see that that follows.
That's not what I do. God is not a conclusion. He's a necessary presupposition to make sense of the law of contradiction.
What I'd like you to do, Si, is maybe run us, if you like, ahead in this, because for those who haven't joined the dots yet as to why God is the necessary, you know, foundational principle.
I've given two already. Existence and logic, you cannot make sense of it without presupposing God. But I can go on from there. I'd like to ask Paul another question. Paul, can anything happen?
Some interesting questions coming from Si. Can anything happen?
Yes, and it probably will.
So you have no reason for trusting that the thoughts in your head and the words you're about to speak mean the same things that they did 5 seconds ago. What is your basis for trusting that the thoughts in your head and the words you're about to speak mean the same things they did 5 seconds ago? What is your basis for trusting that? If anything can happen.
I think that's a very unusual question.
It is.
I think in terms of how I define myself, I can trust it.
Yeah, but I'm asking your basis for trusting it. I'm not asking whether you do or not. You do trust it. That's obvious, because otherwise you wouldn't speak. But in order to speak, you have to trust that the words mean the same thing. You have to trust that the future is like the past. Now, I can give you an account.
So you're asking me, therefore, to trust, as opposed to know for certain or to have absolute evidence.
Basis, that's right. I'm asking you the basis for trusting that the future will be like the past.
Experience.
Now, experience... That also assumes that the future is like the past, because you're assuming...
No, it doesn't. It doesn't.
Because you're talking about the past.
No, experience is a historical record of experience, of literally events.
And what basis do you expect historical events to be valid now?
My experience of previous historical events being repeated. The reason why I do is based on experience.
That's right. You base it on past experience. But this is what I'm pointing out, that these are things that atheists accept on blind faith. They accept that the future will be like the past because it's been like that. That's a viciously circular argument.
No, it's not. That's experience.
That's right. How do you know that your experiences are valid now? How do you know that the future is like the past? And you're talking about the past. That's the very thing that I'm asking you about.
No, I think you're going around in circles.
Well, I think that it's very obvious for the listeners to see who is actually going around in circles.
No, not at all. What you're asking me is, how can I predict the future based on past events?
Right. What is your basis for doing that? How do you know the future is going to be like... You know, you said anything can happen. If anything can happen, what's your basis for assuming that not anything can happen?
Anything can happen. Will anything in all probability happen is a different matter.
Okay, so you're talking about probability now.
Mm-hmm.
You know what probability assumes? Probability assumes that the future will be like the past. You can't say that anything will be probable unless you first assume the certainty that the future is like the past. Probability depends on...
No. You've done it again. You've done it again, Si. You've introduced this absolute word of certainty.
All right,
I cannot be certain about the future.
Right.
But what I can do is make some educated guesses about what is likely to happen based on what has happened in the past. I cannot be certain that... over the next 5 seconds, I don't drop dead, or that a sperm whale doesn't suddenly appear in the studio.
Exactly.
But the likelihood based on past life experiences is that both of those things are actually unlikely. But it is possible,
right,
if anything can happen, that that actually could happen.
So you're invoking probability. My question is, what is your basis for assuming the law of probability is valid?
Again, you go back to experience.
Yeah, so you're saying it's valid because it's been valid. And that's a viciously circular argument. And that's the kind of thing that I think Christians have to point out.
Now look, I understand that you guys aren't going to agree on this, but take us to the next stage, because I think we just need to connect the dots here of your argument, Si, which is, if you believe, obviously, that Paul has is essentially a circular argument, circular reasoning here, but you, Si, would say, look, Paul's experience has to be validated by something other than his experience, okay? And your point is that only God can be, if you like, the guarantor of our experience. That if we want our experience to be, in any sense, to be meaningful or valid, it has to be God, if you like, has to be the one who guarantees it, because it's impossible for us to know, you know, when we're just doing it ourselves.
Right. If we believe in a random chance world that anything can happen, I mean, there is no basis for believing that even your thoughts or speech are valid. Christians believe that because we believe in a sovereign God who controls the universe, who keeps it uniform. The unbeliever has no basis for this, yet they assume it. And that's what I'm saying in this argument, that they assume things that they cannot account for.
I think the two arguments that I would put back to you, Si, are miracles and intercessionary prayer. Right. There you have two instances where something should happen, and there is a probability that something might happen, but that's as far as you go. There is no certainty.
Are you certain about that?
And that, I think, is our problem, isn't it?
Exactly. You say there is no certainty. You make a definitive knowledge claim, but you can't account for that. And throughout the forum, if people read your posts, you argue like a Christian that there are laws of logic which cannot be violated. You argue like a Christian, but then when I press you on those things...
No, I argue on the basis of rationality.
And what is your basis for trusting rationality?
Again, you keep coming back. Keep coming back to my own life experience.
And that's the point, that when a Christian argues this way, we want to be pushed off into talking about dinosaurs and paper fragments and stuff.
Oh, I've not introduced either.
But I know what you're saying, but, I mean, what we've had here is a very interesting interchange between you two, where we've had Paul saying... No, I'm perfect. It's perfectly okay to, in some sense, reason on the basis of my own reasoning, mm-hmm. without introducing God as having to be the guarantor of that. Si, you saying no, your argument is completely circular, and in any other context, you would admonish someone for using that kind of reasoning.
Exactly.
But I suppose what it comes down to for you, Si, is if Paul isn't prepared to admit that he should see things the way you see them, he is suppressing the truth. Going back to this Romans 1 passage, you would say Paul is a typical example of someone suppressing the truth that they really know deep down inside.
That's right. See, the implications of absolutes is that there is a God, so they must deny it, but they don't argue that way. You hear him talking to me about certainty, but the thing is, he denies certainty. He must suppress it, because if he acknowledges it, he acknowledges that he has to submit to the God of the universe, that he's a sinner in this world. But he doesn't want to do that.
Now, my major sort of criticism about presuppositional apologetics is, what is it you're attempting to actually do? And my concern is that, as I think I've posted on the forums, is that presuppositional apologetics is almost trying to bludgeon the non-believer into following the faith. And I don't believe that is a valid method of trying to convince or to convert the non-believer.
Well, the thing is, and that's my point too, people don't convert people. I think that people are converted who are converted through an argument. I think that's a very dangerous thing, because then you get people who are converted through arbitrary experiences, like you decry in the forums.
I mean, one of the great sales mantras that I've heard is, if you win on price, you lose on price. And I think that if you are going to go down the basis of the only way that you can convert somebody is by putting forward some sort of logical argument, then yes, you are also quite likely to lose that person from the faith by the same methodology.
Well, my point is that I can't lose anybody. I can't gain anybody. That's not up to me. I'm commanded to speak the truth. Now, the fundamental apologetic verse, we're told that we have to do this with gentleness and respect. Now, people say they want to defend the faith with paper fragments and stuff like that. How do you do that in an ungentle, unrespected way? It's because it's a powerful argument that we have to do it in gentleness and respect. And that's why I think a lot of times presuppositional apologists are looked down upon, because they have a wonderfully strong, powerful argument that God has given us, and they bludgeon people with it. And that's not what we should
well,
do.
I think, to be honest, you've got this certainty that you have as a presuppositional apologetist. But on the flip side, you are then, if you like, putting Christianity on such a pedestal.
I'm not putting Christianity anywhere.
But you are. You are saying
that
we must all be Christians at heart. Some of us are admitting it, and some of us are in denial. And to do that, you must put Christianity on such a pedestal. We are all Christians. That is the faith. The unfortunate part about that is that Christianity is not as white as the driven snow, is it?
That's also a fallacious argument to say
but
that.
No, it's not. If we are arguing from the basis of absolute morality that we obtain that from God, then the Christianity that exists in the world today should reflect that.
Why, and it
does not.
We're a fallen people. That's the whole point of this. We're fallen. Christ died for our sins. We're not perfect. That's the point.
We're going to have to take a break here, guys, and we will wrap up our discussion in just a short moment. I don't know if you've been following this or not, but we've really kind of gone into a very sort of philosophical ground today as we've asked, can we, if you like, prove the existence of God? But even that, in a sense, is not what Sai is saying. He's saying we don't need to prove God. God simply is, because we can't do anything we do without there being that foundation for our reasoning, for our logic, for our mathematics, for science, for morality. Presuppositional apologetics is what we've been talking about today on the programme. We're going to conclude in just a moment's time here on the show that gets you thinking. Welcome back to the show. Unbelievable gets you thinking every Saturday afternoon here on Premier Christian Radio, engaging your brain. And I don't know about you, but my brain is aching a little bit after that last very philosophically challenging section of the programme. But we'll hear some final thoughts from our guests in just a moment's time. And after that, some of your feedback to previous weeks of programming. Now, next week on the programme, I'm going to be joined by Adrian Warnock. He's the author of the book Raised with Christ. He's a very popular blogger as well. He's going to be explaining why he believes that Christians really can't have any proper theology of resurrection unless they believe in the physical resurrection of Jesus Christ. Opposite him will be a liberal perspective. Jonathan Clatworthy is from Modern Church. He says you don't have to believe in a physical resurrection of Jesus Christ to be a Christian. He believes in a spiritual resurrection, a resurrection, as it were, in the minds of the disciples. So we'll be looking at resurrection theology, a liberal and an evangelical perspective at the same time next week.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
We've been looking at the presuppositional argument for God, this idea that by simply accepting that there are independent laws of logic, mathematics, science and morality, we have to accept that there is a God underpinning that, if you like. Now, there are different ways of formulating this, and one very interesting way in which Sai Ten Bruggenkaet, our guest on the phone from Canada, has done that is by putting together a website, proofthatgodexists.org. And if you go there, it'll take you through a step-by-step process by which it will ask you to evaluate your beliefs about logic and mathematics and things like that, and will inexorably draw you to the conclusion that if you think that way, then God must exist, and you'll get the sense of why it does that. Now, obviously, just going on that website and clicking through the links isn't going to necessarily make you a Christian. But it's an interesting way of putting an argument which floats around in various forms in one way or another. Sai, thank you for being with us on the programme today. I mean, anyone listening to the conversation today will probably be thinking, well, this obviously isn't the most, if you like, you know, knock-down argument out there, because you and Paul have spent a long time discussing it, and you know, in a sense, a lot of people might think, well, this sounds just too complex to even begin to bring to my atheist neighbour across the road. I mean, but your point is actually, no, this is actually at a very fundamental level, very simple. I mean, we may have made it sound complex today, but from your point of view, I understand you think it's just about the most simple argument out there that you can go down.
It's very simple. What we have to do, when the atheist objects to Christianity, we don't give them evidences. We look at what they're standing on. They make absolute objections to Christianity. We have to say, you cannot know anything to be true without assuming that God exists. Now, my focus was initially to bring this argument to atheists, because I have a love for the lost. You know, I would love to see Paul saved. But now I see, you know, especially listening to these shows and looking on the forum, that this argument has to be brought to Christians so they understand the sovereignty of Christ. Because Christians, what they say in church is, nothing can separate me from the love of the Father. I mean, what a beautiful verse. Nothing can separate me from the love of the Father. And then they go out into the world and they say, in the name of open-mindedness, I could be wrong. Now, if they could be wrong, they can't say nothing can separate me from the love of the Father. Christians are being inconsistent. They have to go back to the lordship of Jesus Christ.
So we don't want to be in the same subjective boat as everyone else. We have to stand on something that is immovable. I mean, you say on your website that arguing against God's existence would be on par with arguing against the existence of air, breathing it all the while. Because at the end of the day, an atheist is using the same universal, immaterial, unchanging laws of logic, mathematics, science and absolute morality in order to come to rational decisions, but they simply cannot account for them. So you feel that Paul, on the programme here, is kind of being deliberately obstructive. He's not actually admitting what is actually, should be plain to him, that these laws exist, and that if those laws exist, they have to have a foundation in something beyond just their existence, if you like.
I'm perfectly content to let the listeners of this program make that determination. I mean, they've heard what Paul said, they've heard what he assumed and how he accounts for it. I'm happy to let, because if I tell them that, you know, that has no bearing. Read your Bible, look at the heart of the unbeliever. Don't listen to what they tell them about themselves, listen to what God says about them.
Paul.
Okay, I would certainly say that for me, where I get my morality from, where I get my logic from, where I get my notion of what is true from, is from the way that I was raised, the society that I grew up in, and the social groups that I currently mix with. I would caution against the use of the word absolute. I think it is a killer. And I think I would also caution against trying to prove that God exists, particularly the Christian God exists. I think that as an outsider, Christianity comes across to me as being a belief, and that's how it should be promoted. I think if you are going to try and go down the route of evidence or the route that Si is putting forward, I think that it will put more people off coming to the faith, if that's what they want to do. Because I, from what I see of Si, I don't accept an awful lot of his premises at all. And I also don't accept the ultimate end point that he reaches, which is you must believe in a Christian God. I think that the end point could equally be you could believe in a pagan God, you could believe in Allah, or you could believe in Jehovah, or the Jewish God.
I mean, I was going to raise this with you, Si. Someone might be persuaded, you know, to say, well, actually, yes, I feel like I have to have something to account for my, belief in the laws of logic, and mathematics, etc. Why, on your view, is Allah not the God of Islam, not an acceptable worldview in which to stand for that?
Now, I'm very glad you brought this up, because that brings us back to the heart of the argument. God is not the conclusion to the argument. The God of Christianity is the necessary starting point. If somebody wants to posit Allah, bring them along. Let's hear their argument, and I'll be glad to refute them. But the thing is, that's not what Paul's saying. Now, when somebody says, like, I had a discussion with Stephen Law on his blog. Now, this is a doctor of philosophy. Do you know what his justification was for logic and science and morality? His justification was the invisible pink unicorn. He said to me, you'll discard my philosophy as quickly as I'll discard the God of your philosophy. I said, not at all. I said, bring it on. You book the hall, I'll fly to England, and I'll debate you on a respective justifications. And you know what he said to me? As long as I can say I'm arguing a parody. I said, if you're arguing a parody, what's your justification? Now, if somebody wants to argue that, you know, the God of Islam is a justification, I'll be happy to discuss this with them. I'll say the same thing. How do you know what you know? They'll say, well, it says it in the Quran. What does the Quran say about the Bible?
But what
the
do you Quran do?
Says
what,
that the what, Bible is true.
What do you do about a faith that isn't codified?
What do I do about it? I know for certain, because no, as you admitted, God can reveal things to us such that we can know them for certain. I know that God is the only God. If that pagan wants to bring on...
How do you know? I'm throwing the question now that you've thrown to me back to you.
Ask me
how do you know?
You conceded that I can know things for certain based on God's revelation. That's my argument. I can know things because God has revealed it to us in the Old and New Testament.
On a personal level, yes, but your personal knowledge is no better than mine.
Are you certain of that?
Within my own knowledge, yes, of my own beliefs.
Certain of that. You're not certain of that because you don't believe in certainty. And I'm saying that God can and has revealed things to us such that we can know it for certain. And one of the things he's revealed to us is that he exists. That's, Paul, why you are destined for hell aside from repentance, because you know in your heart of heart that he exists. And that's why...
Well, that's a completely separate argument, Si, which... One minute. having seen, and I have actually posted this on the forum, I'm quite happy, based on the criteria that's being put forward about what a Christian is and how a Christian gets into heaven, I am actually quite looking forward to going to hell, because there's an awful lot of very, very good people who are not Christians, who by virtue of not fulfilling that criteria, who are going to hell, and I'll be quite happy to go with them.
You know, and that is my point, too, that the gates of hell are locked on the inside. People, they don't want God, and in the end, God is going to grant them their request. But I tell you, you can talk about that now, but Paul, I urge you to repent, because you will not be happy with it.
We are going to have to draw it to a close there, gents. It's been an interesting one for me because, in a sense, it's at the very foundational starting points of what we're prepared to grant each other that this argument comes into play. I think I would have to grant to Si that if you did accept the premises that Si is putting forward, there's a certain power in this argument. It feels like a kind of... And you see it, as Si mentioned, sort of popping up in different guises, in different shows. Particularly the moral argument is a typical one, you know, where one would say, you know, this argument that if absolute morals exist, and many people agree that they do, then there has to be a sort of... basis on which we agree on what those morals are. But we've run over time already on the show, so we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you, gentlemen, both, for coming on the show. If you want to continue this online, I'm sure Si and perhaps Paul as well would be willing to engage on the forum. In fact, I'm sure those gentlemen will probably post something up there in the near future. So look out for that. Go to premier.org.uk/unbelievable. You can download this episode of the podcast. You can also click through to the Unbelievable group of the Premier community and continue the discussion there. So thanks again to my guest today, looking at the presuppositional argument for the existence of God. And we're going to go to some of your responses to some of our other shows, which have been dealing more in the evidential side, I suppose. But I'm sure you'll want to respond to this as well. I'll give you the details of how to do that again in just a moment's time.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, I have actually managed to confirm that there is indeed a conversation going on at the Premier community about that very subject that we've been talking about today, presuppositional apologetics. So if you want to see what Si 10B and Paul Baird, how they're continuing this conversation we've started today on the Premier community, then just click through to the Unbelievable group of the community. You can do that by going to the webpage, as I say, premier.org.uk/unbelievable, and click on the link to the Premier community. So lots of your emails to get through still, and still just mopping up the last few, and this will have to be the last few on that show of a few weeks ago now with Be Strong and JT. Be Strong, somewhat controversial, a choice of atheist, well, agnostic guest, really, on this programme. Many people objected that he simply wasn't scholarly enough. His approach demeaned, as it were, the way this programme normally is carried out because of the way he argued against the historicity of Jesus in quite a unique fashion. Gareth, though, wanted to say, I've been listening to the last few weeks of Unbelievable whilst painting my in-law's barn. About 90 square yards of corrugated metal, and it doesn't half help to make the time pass quicker. I've just finished listening to the debate with Be Strong. At certain points during the debate, I thought that my MP3 player must have broken because Mr. Strong seemed to be repeating the same things over and over again. But then I realised this was just his way of debating. It's a cunning syllogism called the argument from serious assertion. The basic form of the argument goes like this. 1. God does not exist. 2. No, seriously, God does not exist. 3. Therefore, God does not exist, repeated with added volume until the listener gives in. All joking aside, I thought that Mr. Strong's style made it a very entertaining episode, and I admire the spirit of grace and fair play in which both your guests conducted the debate. I'm very much looking forward to the show with Susan Blackmore. Well, that was obviously a show of a couple of weeks ago, so thank you for that that email that you sent in at the time of that debate, Gareth, and somewhat different reaction to many of the people who have emailed in, if you heard any of the reactions last week as well. But Ken as well actually quite enjoyed the show. He says, very interesting discussion between lapsed believer B. Strong from the USA and apologist JT in the studio. It was sad to hear that the stumbling stone of tithing led B. Strong down the wrong path. Unfortunately, he demonstrated how easy it is to get stuck on the wrong path through obstinacy. JT, who was a very good apologist, calmly demolished all of B. Strong's assertions, yet he wouldn't budge an inch because he's now defending his authorship. B. Strong's house is built on sand, but he is clearly determined to defend the indefensible. Saul changed his name to Paul. B. Strong should change his to being foolish. Thank you very much, Ken. And that draws to a close our sort of feedback on B. Strong, who made quite an impact and has made an impact on the Premier community in terms of the debate that is still high up, charting high on his performance on the show. So let's go to some other emails. And I'm going to take you back even further now to those shows we did with Victor Stenger, the atheist physicist over from the US. We got hold of him for a couple of shows, particularly the second show he did with David Bartholomew, asking, is intercessory prayer a valid way of testing for whether God actually exists? Testing the God hypothesis. And we've already heard it, some of your emails on this whole idea of setting up prayer experiments and whether we can logically say that that's a way of testing for God. Here's Matthew, who says, another ring-dinger of a show that you had between Victor and David. We're often told that one of the foundations of modern science is to leave the supernatural out of it. So this discussion on the God hypothesis seems to be somewhat of an anomaly. For example, people condemn the mixing of science and the Bible. And yet here we have to take full consideration of the Bible before we can say whether the data supports or contradicts the God hypothesis. I actually admire Victor Stenger for the courage to think outside of the box and try to apply the scientific method to God. But I agree with David Bartholomew, for the most part, that one has to be extremely careful with the conclusions of such an approach, and I'm not sure that I could justify public funding for such research. I think one of the biggest problems with investigating the God question is the issue of objectivity. For example, Bart Ehrman's take on the Bible is anything but objective, because Ehrman rejects miracles and the supernatural. If Victor wants to refute the God that the average Christian believes in, then he needs to look at the Bible through the eyes of the average Christian, not through the eyes of Bart Ehrman. I think what comes through most clearly in the debate is that Victor is holding the data up to a God that the average Christian doesn't actually believe in. Like David, I would be surprised if any of my prayers worked in such an experiment because of my view of God. But what would be very interesting is if such an investigation were to take into account my or David's view of God, would there be a way to measure spiritual health of the patients involved, for example, not just physical healing? Thank you, Matthew. Alexa, with a shorter email on that subject, says, to think that you can test God is a ridiculous notion. If humans can scientifically test God, then humans have risen above God. Pride corrupts logic. That's all I have to say for now. Thanks for the podcast. It's awesome. Sarah is in the USA. Good to get some female contributors coming in on the email. Usually overwhelmed with the men, but good to see some ladies getting involved. You say, Sarah, I'd like to comment on last week's programme. Firstly, well, this was actually a few weeks back now. Firstly, in regard to Mr. Stenger's belief that testing prayer in a lab is sufficient evidence for whether or not God responds to it is absurd. It should go without saying that God is not going to respond to tests being run as if he were a rat in a lab experiment. For this reason, I dismiss those statistics as evidence entirely. Second, I feel comfortable sharing my story of answered prayer to make a point, because prayer is not always answered when we expect it to be. I am an epileptic and had terrible seizures growing up from the time I was 8 through to 13. There were many people praying for me as I continued to get worse. When I finally made the decision to pray for myself, right before papers were about to be signed for brain surgery, God answered. The weekend after I prayed, when the papers were to be signed, my doctor proposed one last medicine that was quite new at the time, and I've been on it ever since. I'm 20 now, and I haven't had a seizure for 7 years, and considering coming off the medicine, as I don't believe I need it anymore. Now, that's answered prayer. Though God responded to my prayer quite quickly, he was at the same time responding to those of others who had been praying for me, because I eventually got better. I got better on God's time so that he could use my illness to show his glory. One thing I think Mr. Stenger doesn't understand is that prayer is not always answered immediately or in the way we expect. God sees the big picture of the now and future and has a plan for us which may influence how and when he answers our prayers. Thank you very much, Sarah. Thought-provoking email. Hamilton in the United Arab Emirates on this subject of the God hypothesis and whether it fails on these prayer scientific experiments says, unlike my past feedback, I must say that show I felt was unusually lacking depth in terms of sound arguments. I didn't think the Christian side was well defended, and Victor seems to have gotten away very easily on some issues without challenge. Moreover, the subjectivity and lack of objectivity expressed by David, your Christian guest, was clearly not sound Christian apologetics here. Nevertheless, if I were to ask Victor a couple of questions, here's what they would be. I think if this was the basis, that every individual were to test God by using a simple experiment, such as asking God to drop a $100 bill from the sky, and if God did not oblige, were we to conclude a non-existence on that basis? It sounds like the intercessory prayer model was the only argument being put forth through the show, and it's just plain old nonsense. Secondly, also, your experiment rests on God's attributes of benevolence and omnipotence, etc. Where does he draw these conclusions from? Yet when being pointed to a scriptural passage of not putting God to the test, why do you point it out to be a theological issue? Again, double standards. Thirdly, I would also request Victor to revisit and study the Christian defence given on the basis of the apostles giving their life for the truth. That's simply not an equivalent of a Japanese kamikaze fighter pilot. Thanks very much for the shows. Okay, I think time for one more on the God hypothesis, maybe. Here we go. This is from Luke McGurdy. A really interesting email, and though it's long, I am going to read out the whole thing, Luke. It was a very interesting show, you say. Is God a failed hypothesis statistically? And let me just remind you, if you're wondering, what is this show that Justin's going on about? This was from about a month or so back, and you can hear it on the Premier Archive, of course, at premier.org.uk/unbelievable. Two shows that we did with Victor Stenger, the atheist scientist. The first one, is God a failed hypothesis philosophically? The second one, is God a failed hypothesis statistically? So here's what Luke has to say. My main reason for emailing you centres around the subject matter that began that debate, namely intercessory prayer trials. Before I detail my concerns about these trials, let me first explain that what follows is equally applicable to all prayer trials, irrespective of their findings. In other words, whatever the data shows, be it a positive correlation between prayer and health or a negative correlation, I am deeply sceptical of their worth. So with that qualifier out of the way, let me proceed to the point of this email. My understanding of the purpose behind any double-blind experiment is that by concealing the identity of the group type, control or treatment from the participants and the researchers, subjective bias is hoped to be eliminated. However, the problem with prayer trials is that there's no way of reliably determining if the control group is actually a control group. Why? Researchers can't, for example, factor out the prayers of a child who last night prayed to God to help all the sick people on earth get better. Similarly, researchers cannot eliminate the possibility that a friend, relative, neighbour or anybody else outside the trial isn't praying fervently for the recovery of somebody who, unbeknownst to them, happens to be in a control group of a prayer trial. There is also an assumption in these trials that God's goal is to make sick people better. For reasons I'll touch on later, I believe that this is an unjustified assumption that's simply too simplistic. Perhaps I'm missing some rather obvious point here. This isn't unusual for me, but until such time that my misunderstanding is explained, I believe that these types of trials are fundamentally flawed, and the results they produce are unreliable and surely unscientific. I'm disappointed that this wasn't pointed out by David Partholomew or on a previous occasion by Adrian Holloway when he debated Michael Shermer on a similar topic. I think fundamentally, your point was essentially at the centre of David's argument in some ways, Luke, so I'd take issue slightly with you there. But anyway, carrying on, you say, by way of other criticisms, I was struck how insistent Victor Stenger was that he was doing science. Yet, despite the words of David Bartholomew, he didn't seem to realise that he often lapsed into imposing his subjective metaphysical reasoning onto the debate, specifically with regards to the apparent hiddenness of God, the evidence for Christ, and the nature of God's purpose. With regards to the hiddenness of God, Victor claimed that he should be detectable in creation or nature if he exists. quite aside from the fact that many people think that creation itself points to some type of creator being. Anthony Flew would be a recent example of someone who converted to this position after a lifetime's dedication to atheism. I wonder why God should be obliged to produce results that are agreeable to Victor Stenger, especially if he is on the outside looking in. With regards to evidence for Christ, Victor fails to acknowledge that he is applying his own subjective reasoning when he boldly dismisses other types of non-physical evidence for the existence of Christ as foolish. And finally, on the nature of God's purpose, I think it's quite conceivable to suggest that from reading the Bible, one can fairly conclude that God isn't primarily concerned with our physical well-being. Rather, it seems to me that God is concerned with personal salvation and the eventual renewal of all creation. Perhaps this is what David Bartholomew meant when he criticised Victor Stenger for his lack of understanding about the very thing he attacks. Thank you very much for that email. I think that really gives a very interesting sort of look at how many of you responded to that those debates between Victor Stenger and the Christian guests we had on. Well, we've come to the end of the show for today. Do join me again at the same time next week, and let me tell you what's coming up then.
You're unbelievable.
I'm joined in the studio next week by Adrian Warnock, who's the author of the book Raised with Christ. Adrian believes that to be a Christian, you need to believe in the physical resurrection of Christ. Opposite him will be a liberal perspective. That's coming from Reverend Jonathan Clatworthy of Modern Church. He says you don't have to believe in a physical resurrection to have a good resurrection theology. We'll be looking at how their theologies differ because of their beliefs about the resurrection of Jesus. So I hope you can join me for that show. It'll get you thinking. We always do here on the programme for Christians and non-Christians alike. Unbelievable. See you next week.